I think we've reached a point where it requires a lot more work and actual discernment than it used to.
Journalist Mark Hemingway, speaker at the 2021 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, July 23rd and 24th at Concordia University, Chicago.
Just because you read something in black and white does not mean that it's in any way reliable. And in fact, you should probably assume that the default media worldview is hostile to, say, a Lutheran worldview, and act accordingly in terms of verifying that information with multiple sources and using your best judgment in terms of who you trust and who you don't.
You can participate in a Q&A with Mark and Molly Hemingway at this year's Making the Case Conference. The premier conference for Christian laity is Friday, July 23rd and Saturday, July 24th in Chicago. Attendance is limited. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org or by calling 618-223-8385.
Postmodernism, in its sort of rejection of truth overall, has left this one area of truth remaining, and that's the lens of power.
So somewhere in between that time where I had that strong reaction to a Sanctity of Life Sunday and being offered an abortion, God changed my heart completely, and it was receiving God's word, properly distinguished law and gospel, that changed my heart.
Scientism takes the tool of science and it leverages it to justify a grand narrative of the universe, specifically without God or without reference to things divine.
Baptism is a work of Jesus to cleanse, to sanctify, to forgive His holy Christian church.
Hi, this is Jeff from Lithia, Florida. Beloved on-demand treadmill runners love Issues Etc.
If you listen frequently to the program, we talk about the low birth rate. It's important for a lot of reasons. We know that in America, the birth rate is below replacement levels. That means you have a mother and a father, and to replace them, you need more than two children. Usually the number they say is 2.1. That's a demographer's way of thinking about it. It's at 1.7. What does that mean for our future, our children's and our grandchildren's futures? Are policies like universal child care or paternal leave or cash for kids, do they hold the potential for turning that birth rate around? And do developed countries, all of whom have falling birth rates, do they have to choose between the birth rate and economic growth? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc., coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be talking with Lyman Stone about workism and fertility. A little bit later, we'll go through listener email and the Issues Etc. comment line. That email address, talkback at issuesetc.org, and the comment line, 618-223-8382. Then, in hour two, we will study the Lenten hymn, My Song is Love Unknown. I think that's a favorite Lenten hymn of a lot of people. Pastor Will Whedon, host of The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, will be our guest. Joining us to talk about workism and fertility, Lyman Stone. He's a regular guest, research fellow at the Institute for Family Studies, chief information officer of the population research firm Demographic Intelligence, adjunct fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and co-author of a new study, More Work, Fewer Babies. Lyman, welcome back.
It's good to be with you.
Demographers usually posit a cause and effect relationship between high incomes and low birth rates. Why do they do that, and does that kind of relationship exist?
Sure. So the relationship between income and fertility is going to vary depending on the context. We see that richer countries tend to have fewer babies. Within a country, there's some variation, but generally we think of it as middle-class people tend to have the fewest babies. The very rich and working-class people tend to have more babies. But then the economic cycle is quite the opposite. The people tend to have more babies in good times and fewer babies in bad times. So there's all kinds of different relationships between income and economic development and all these things and the fertility that people have. So the relationship between market outcomes like income and fertility turns out to be pretty complicated.
Why should policymakers be concerned about low birth rates?
Well, there's a lot of reasons. Obviously, things like with a low birth rate, you get a lower population growth rate, and then that's going to give you lower economic growth, less entrepreneurship, less innovation, higher inequality. It's going to make It's going to make it harder to finance intergenerational transfers like Social Security or Medicare, or even things like the stock market, which depends on a next generation of consumers to buy the products of the companies whose assets are trade or whose securities are traded. There's all these broader economic effects that are very interesting to some policymakers, but I think they're kind of missing the real problem, which is that a world where people don't have the children that they want to have is a world of more people growing old alone. It's a world of more people spending their later years closed off from many of the joyful milestones and moments that come in younger years. It's an increasingly generationally divided society, and one with a lot more loneliness and unhappiness. And that in itself is a problem, regardless of sort of broader socioeconomic effects.
What are work-focused value sets and life courses?
So I've just published a paper where me and a co-author, a researcher at Catholic University of America, we look around the world in almost 100 countries over something like 40 years of data at surveys that ask people about the things they prioritize in life. And one of the things we're really interested in is the priorities that they place on family and work. How important do they say work is? How important do they say family is? And what does that tell us about fertility outcomes? And what we found is that in poorer countries, people who say work is very important tend to have more babies, right? That if you say work is really important, you tend to have more babies, which actually that makes sense. In poorer countries, you have a lot of people in a lot of precarious economic situations. Work really is important for mere survival, if nothing else. But in higher income countries, the relationship flips. The more people say that work is important, and when I say people, I mean men and women. This isn't just about women valuing work. Men who value work have fewer children. The more you value work, the more your society values work, the fewer children you end up having. So we found this relationship operating at the individual level and at the country level, and we duplicated it across four different international survey data sets, using different types of questions, different types of models. So we're confident it's a pretty strong relationship that basically in the great competition of what rules your life, work and family are, well, God and mammon don't go together very well, and neither does mammon and babies.
We have been told that increased gender equality would lead to an increase in the birth rate. What did you discover?
So there is some evidence that as societies become highly gender egalitarian, that there might be some stabilization in fertility rates. So basically, the argument goes that as women get public equality, that is, they enter the workforce, politics, legal equality, things like this in the public sphere, they continue to experience inequality at home, right? Husbands who don't help out with the chores or don't help raise the kids or things like that. And so rather than have a child and take on a second shift as worker and mom, they forego fertility. So the argument has been that if we can get equality in the at-home sphere, that is, if we can get men to pick up more of their fair share of the burden, that fertility would rise. And there's some evidence for that. And we certainly didn't disprove that thesis. But we did complicate it because we found that, sure, while maybe gender egalitarianism matters, if you achieve gender egalitarianism, or if you try to think about it as just division of labor, who works how much, and you don't think about the total amount of labor or the total value that people place on labor, if you don't think about the overall position of that family in regards to the labor market, then you're missing an important part of the story. It doesn't matter how egalitarian a couple is. If they're both working 45-hour weeks in careers that they see as the primary source of their meaning and identity in life, there's just not going to be many children. There's just not time for them. It doesn't matter how equally you divide things at home in that scenario. There's just going to be fewer children.
What did you discover about the role of gender ideology?
So gender ideology in general, and what we mean by gender ideology is things like, specifically we measure it using a question that says basically when jobs are scarce, should men get priority? And relatively small shares of people in most countries say yes to that question. In high income countries say yes to that question. It's actually not an extremely common belief for people to like strongly agree with. But what we do find is that people with more sort of gender unequal or gender inegalitarian values, that is people who tend to say, yeah, when jobs are short, men should get priority, they tend to have slightly more children. But the effect of gender egalitarianism is much, much smaller than the effect of the generalized importance that people place on work. It is true that people with more egalitarian or more progressive values have a little bit fewer children, but it's swamped by these other effects.
Do government policies that attempt to increase fertility through programs like universal childcare or paternal leave actually increase fertility? If not, why?
So there's a lot of research on this question. And there is stuff that the government can do. And in general, most of the research finds that when governments implement programs to try to increase fertility, they tend to succeed. Now, sometimes it's very expensive. Sometimes you spend a lot of money and you only succeed a little bit. But on the simple question of, is it possible to raise through fertility by sort of throwing government money at it? The answer is yes. But it can be quite costly. And so given that it's quite costly, there's definitely an interest in cost effectiveness. What's the cheapest way to do this? And the answer, the cheapest way is to give people cash. That in terms of what's the cheapest way, how can you spend the least money to get the most bang for your buck in terms of government policies to promote childbearing, cash benefits tend to have the largest effect. Whereas programs like parental leave for employed parents or universal childcare, they do tend to have positive effects, but they're somewhat smaller. This is a finding that's somewhat debated in the field. Often you'll see things like the New York Times ran an article just maybe 2 weeks ago claiming the exact opposite of this. But that claim was essentially based on a misreading of some of the academic evidence and on citing a paper, which was a fine paper for what it was, but it wasn't a meta-analysis of all the studies on this. So I conducted such a meta-analysis. And what we find is that if you want more babies, the simplest way to do it is to just give people cash for kids.
What is familism?
Familism. Well, so we have this idea of workism, right? That it's how important you say work is. It's the meaning and value that you place on market labor. Familism is something that we contrast to that. That is, how important do you say family is, or how much do you see family as being essential to your happiness, to your well-being, to your satisfaction in life? So obviously, these things don't necessarily have to be in tension. In principle, you could see both of these things as very important, but often they are in tension. You know, what's the number one reason you miss your kid's t-ball game? Well, because you had a work thing. You know, what's the number one reason that when Susie, my 14-month-old, when she runs up to me carrying a book going, book, 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 and she wants me to read to her, what's the number one reason I say no? Well, it's because I'm working. I'm busy. So we see these things as very much in tension. So in a lot of our models, we contrast these. We say, we're not just interested in workism, we're interested in the contrast between workism and familism. And we actually have one study, and it's a survey of reproductive age American women where we explicitly ask respondents to rank these 10 things. It's things like, you know, family and work and patriotism and religion and pets and all these different things. We ask them to rank their importance to them, and then we can get this really granular measurement of how important people think family is versus how important they think work is, or a meaningful career is what we asked. And what we find is that the higher people rank the importance of family and particularly the importance of marriage, the more children they have and the more children they intend to have and the more children they want to have. And the higher that people rank the importance of having a meaningful career, the fewer children they have, the fewer children they want to have, and the fewer children that they intend to have.
What kind of public policies would encourage familism?
That's a great question. I think it's easier to think about what kind of public policies do not encourage familism. So you can think of something like universal childcare. What is universal childcare? Well, we say it's helping, you know, maybe it's providing high quality care for kids, or maybe it's helping families balance their sort of work-life balance. But who uses childcare? Well, it's disproportionately people for whom all parents are working, right? It's essentially a subsidy for working parents. People who have one parent at home are far less likely to be using public childcare. That being the case, we have to think about what that kind of policy is really doing. What it's telling parents is, if you're a parent who also is working in the marketplace, you're more valuable to society. You're more important. Your life choice is more worth socially rewarding, praising, lauding, glorifying. And if you choose to stay home, well, shame on you. You don't get as many benefits. You don't get as much support. So this clearly encourages workism. It's the government catechizing and saying what is good, true, and beautiful in life is for mom to work as much as possible, or for dad to work as much as possible. It's for parents to spend as little time during the day with their kids as can be managed. I think if when we think about familistic policy, we want to try and challenge that. Now, of course, we have to accept the reality that two-income families are, by and large, the norm. That's not going to change, and I'm not even saying it should change. But I think we do need to find ways to stop just running up extra benefits for parents who already have two workers and thus have the least need for help because they have the highest incomes, and instead be thinking about what we can be doing to make the time that parents spend with their children more rewarding, less stressful, and allow them to spend more of it.
Lyman Stone is our guest. We're talking about workism and fertility. When we come back, are there differences between men and women on attitudes toward work and family? Stay tuned. You can meet and hear Mark and Molly Hemingway, Robert George, Brian Wolfmiller, Larry Rast, and Will Wheaton at the 2021 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. Making the Case is Friday, July 23rd and Saturday, July 24th at Concordia University, Chicago. Early bird registration is $135. Learn more at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. Making the Case, July 23rd and 24th in Chicago.
Remember when education was about the fundamental skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic? And about reading great literature and studying history to give our kids a model for what it is to be a good person? Memoria Press's classical Christian curriculum offers that very model for your homeschool. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR21. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Others talk. We have something to say. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Superstition is the belief that one event caused an unrelated event. It's often tied up with false beliefs about God and how he works in the world. Is there really such a problem with superstitions? Is there really such a problem with saying knock on wood or good luck? Explore this and more in the March issue of The Lutheran Witness. We will talk about scientism, superstition, New Age, and so much more. To order your copy, visit cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Listen to chapel services live, weekday mornings from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Morning Chapel from Kramer Chapel. Live weekday mornings at 9 Central, 10 Eastern, 8 Mountain, and 7 Pacific at issuesetc.org.
We don't want the word to get out that we want to completely exterminate the Negro population. That's a Margaret Sanger's quote. So that was right when she was starting Planned Parenthood, and that was the goal, that was the intent.
I want to be the rich man now, and I want to be Lazarus later. Can't we arrange this, Lord? You know, and Jesus invites us, come on and be Lazarus now. Don't worry about it. I've got the end covered.
We really do know a lot more about the virus biology, how it spreads, and how it causes disease.
What needs to be overcome, though, is the way in which this is working itself out by picking a particular group, for the moment, the white heterosexual male, and saying he's responsible for all the sins of the world.
Tomorrow afternoon, Friday, March 19th, we'll play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. Listeners with the best votes win the LPR bundle package. You'll find this week's contestants in Tuesday's podcast feed and on the Talk on Demand archives page at issuesetc.org. You can vote in advance at facebook.com/issuesetc. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, a tweet at issuesetc. You can also vote live from 4:30 to 5 Central tomorrow afternoon at 1-877-623-MYIE. Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. We're talking with Lyman Stone about workism and fertility. He's co-author of a new study, More Work, Fewer Babies. Lyman, are there differences between men and women on attitudes toward work and family?
That's a great question. A little bit. Men tend to be a little bit more workist. Women tend to be a little bit more familist. But that difference is, it varies by country. And it isn't actually overall very large. That was actually one of the surprising things about our study is that gender differences turn out to be, on these attitudes, turn out to be a lot smaller than you might think.
Do developed countries have to choose, and this is kind of the bottom line question, do they have to choose between an increased birth rate and economic growth?
I don't think that that's a choice that we face, not least because in the long run, a marginally higher intended birth rate is good for economic growth. Crucially, what I would say is when you think about the next 40 years of American economic growth, do you really think that we help economic growth by doing less parenting? I don't think that the answer to that is yes. I don't think that society on the whole is better off, even in purely economic terms, by having less intentional parental influence in children's lives. Because the reality is, when you don't get that influence, there are costs to society. Kids who do worse in school, higher delinquency rates, ultimately less acquisition of the hard and soft skills necessary for success in a modern market, differences in crime rates, differences in future dependency on state support. So I think that what we should really be asking is, are we willing to take a hit to labor force participation today in exchange for more broad-based economic growth over the next generation or two? And for me, I would say the answer is yes. I'm a parent. I'm perfectly happy to take a hit today if it means a better life for my daughter. And I think many parents feel the same way. And we certainly feel that way in our own personal lives, right? We make sacrifices for our children all the time. But I think we rarely translate that into our policymaking reasoning, that I want to incur whatever suffering is necessary in policy terms, in economic terms, today, as soon as possible, if it means making a worthwhile investment that will pay off over the course of my daughter's or her children's lives. And so that's I think, what we're thinking about in this report as we talk about this contrast between workism and familism, is that if you can get everybody totally focused on work and deriving meaning from it and thinking that this is the most important thing in life, yeah, that might increase your labor force participation rate for a little while. But in the long run, that's not sustainable. It leads to very low rates of fertility, and it leads to very high rates of parental disengagement. And those both have consequences for society that are going to come back to bite us.
What specific challenges do policymakers concerned about low birth rates face?
There are so many challenges, and there are so many trade-offs. So there's a big debate right now about child allowances. You know, Senator Romney proposed a budget-neutral child allowance that it was also pro-marriage and all this stuff. It didn't really go anywhere. And then President Biden has gotten this temporary child allowance passed, which will also raise the deficit, and it has some increases in marriage penalties in the same law. So Romney's plan, I like. Biden's plan, not so much. But there's all these trade-offs. So, you know, we talk about single parenthood, and a lot of conservative policy experts say, well, gosh, isn't this going to, if this child allowance, won't it increase single parenthood? Because if you give people cash for kids, they'll be able to get by without working and without the support of a spouse. And so won't this increase single parenthood? And if true, that's a legitimate concern, because single parenthood can have adverse effects on kids' economic mobility and things like that. And so this is a concern that we have to think about, is are we going to, so to speak, help kids or help parents spend time with their kids, but in exchange, we get more sort of permanently welfare-dependent single parenthood? That would be an unfortunate trade-off. So we have to get into some really thorny, sort of wonkish debates about this. And I have an article that'll come out hopefully in the next week or two where I comprehensively review what we know about child allowances and single parenthood. And it, of course, turns out that child allowances reduce single parenthood, contrary to what people might expect. And you can see examples of this in the United Kingdom or even Quebec or a few other cases, but also just across all the countries with child allowances. When child allowances go up, single parenthood falls. But then we also have things about abortion. What effect do child allowances have on abortion? Some people might wonder about that. I wrote an article about that, and it turns out child allowances reduce abortion. But what happens when you reduce abortion? Well, those kids are born. And what kind of family are kids who would have been aborted usually born into? Well, poor single families. So now they're on welfare, probably. So you get this trade-off where some conservatives say, oh, we don't want to drive up, you know, welfare dependency. But if we keep welfare dependency down by aborting those children, I'm pretty sure that's not winning. So there's a lot of very complicated trade-offs in these debates. Now, I'm, of course, in favor of a child allowance, but I recognize that there are challenging questions and trade-offs that my fellow conservatives have to take very seriously.
Are there any countries out there that demonstrate a path to egalitarianism that hasn't resulted in a low birth rate?
The classic example of this has been the Nordic countries, like Sweden and Norway and Denmark and these places. And they were always held up as like, look, they're very egalitarian and they have relatively high birth rates because they have some of the highest birth rates in the rich world. But in the last decade or so, their birth rates have plummeted along with everyone else. So, whoops, didn't turn out so well. You know, I think a key finding in our study is that there are bigger things out there than gender egalitarianism. There are just a lot of other forces that are a lot more important. There's a lot of focus on gender egalitarianism as an issue because it's politically powerful, because it energizes a lot of our sort of intuitions of political coalitions and who the good guys are and who the bad guys are and big ideological movements we're all familiar with. But the ideological movement I'm concerned about is the idolatry of work, is the obsession with logging your hours and finding your worth in what your customers say you're worth or what your employer says you're worth. We like to focus on these sort of hot button questions around sex, because they're titillating. But I think that we often do this to the detriment of focusing on the things that are perhaps most essential to our well-being, particularly in a Christian community, which is looking at the things that really, really draw us away from our families, looking at the things that really distract us when we're sitting in the pew. Am I distracted by feminist discourse? No, I'm distracted by thinking about work. That's why I'm not paying attention to the sermon. What are the things that are actually in our life taking us away from faithfully receiving the good things of God? And I think a careful inspection will suggest that it is precisely what Christ said it is, and that is that all too often it is the love of money or pride in our own ability to make things. Now, God put man in the garden to work. We have vocations. I'm not saying that we should become ascetics and retreat to the hills and never work again, but I think it's quite reasonable to suggest that modern American culture worships the market and the employment relationship more than it ought to.
Finally, with about a minute here, Lyman, the current birth rate in the U.S. is under 2. I think it's 1.7, and it really doesn't show any signs of increasing as far as I can tell. What does that mean for our society long term?
As we said it at the top of this interview, in the long run, it means more lonely people. It means more people detached from joyous moments as they age. It means a lot of people not getting the life they wanted to have and probably not entirely happy about that. It simply means an angry and more miserable future.
Lyman Stone is research fellow at the Institute for Family Studies, chief information officer of the population research firm Demographic Intelligence, adjunct fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and co-author of the new study, More Work, Fewer Babies. You can read it and learn more about a webinar at 6:30 Eastern tonight featuring Lyman and the co-author of More Work, Fewer Babies, Lori DeRose, at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. Lyman, thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, it's listener email, talkback@issuesetc.org, and the Issues Etc. listener comment line, 618-223-8382. You can help new Christians or those curious about the true Easter miracle with the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March, A Simple Explanation of Easter. These booklets are sold in packets of 20, making them perfect for outreach programs, new member classes, and in-church pews. Find out more about A Simple Explanation of Easter at issuesetc.org or by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month, A Simple Explanation of Easter.
LCMS Life Ministry is hosting a virtual life conference, Making Disciples, Valuing Life, on March 19th and 20th. Dozens of experts in life ministry will present and answer questions throughout the conference in on-demand videos and live sessions. Participate in the conference, be equipped to speak up for the sanctity of life, and gain ideas on how to care for life. Join us as we build a team for new life ministry challenges. Register now at lcms-life.org, lcms-life.org.
Imagine this. What if you planned your vacation? You picked the location based upon where you knew there was a good Lutheran church. Well, we're here to let you know that if you're planning a Southern Oregon vacation, whether you visit Crater Lake, raft the Rogue, fish for salmon, or head down to the Redwoods, there's still a place for you to receive forgiveness. Faith Lutheran Church in Rogue River, Oregon. What's a vacation without the gospel? Faith Lutheran Church, Sundays at 10 a.m. Visit faithrogueriver.org.
Concordia University Chicago is committed to keeping college affordable for all, and especially for LCMS Lutherans. We have scholarships available specifically for students who are LCMS members. This is Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia Chicago, asking you to encourage your student to check out Concordia Chicago at cuchicago.edu. And if you are interested in supporting these scholarships, please find us online at foundation@cuchicago.edu.
Contending for truth in an age of antitruth, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by becoming an Issues Etc. congregational sponsor: Bethel Lutheran, Ballinger, Texas; Epiphany Lutheran, Door, Michigan; Grace Lutheran, Naples, Florida; Emmanuel Lutheran, Holloway, Minnesota; Mount Calvary Lutheran, Lititz, Pennsylvania; Peace Lutheran, Fresno, California; Reformation Lutheran, Hillsboro, Oregon; St. John Lutheran, Springfield, Pennsylvania; St. Paul Lutheran, Wildwood, Missouri; and Trinity Lutheran, Wichita, Kansas. Find out how your confessional Lutheran church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click Support, Donate, and print the one-page flyer. When your congregation becomes an Issues Etc. sponsor, we'll publicize your church on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal.